Hello, I'm Christopher Kissan, and this is Ireland's Edge. On today's episode, the generational divide over climate action. While most of the world agrees with the scientific fact that humans are dangerously altering the Earth's climate, we can't agree on what to do about it. Global powers and corporate giants quarrel over who should do what, while generations argue with each other about the need for urgency. In a global crisis where the blame and the damage are unequally distributed, how do we create the consensus needed to act before it's too late? Today I'm joined by three fascinating guests who see climate change from different perspectives. Alex White is a senior counsel and is director of the Institute for International and European Affairs. He was previously a TD and senator, as well as a government minister in multiple departments. Martha Farrell is a lecturer at Munster Technological University in Tralee and a founding member of the Maharees Conservation Association, an award-winning volunteer organisation set up to protect a vital tombolo here on the Dingle Peninsula. And Caitlin Fay Maniti is a student at Maynooth University who was previously president of the Irish Second Level Students' Union. She contributes to Ireland's National Youth Assembly and was a co-author of a recent UNICEF Ireland report on the impact of climate change on children. They joined me in front of a live audience at Ireland's Edge in Dingle. So Alex, I wonder if I could start by asking you. You were Minister for Communications, Energy and Natural Resources, which is now the Minister of the Environment portfolio, up until 2016. Where are we in the years since then? I mean, in some ways it feels that climate change is much more on the political agenda, and yet at the same time we see this year is going to be 1.5 degrees warmer than the pre-industrial era, which at one stage we thought was a kind of a line that we wouldn't ever want to cross, and yet we're sort of steaming past that.
Well, I think when you do the balance sheet, you know, and look back over the last decade, I think you have to come down initially with where, with exactly what you said, where there's a crisis of enormous, really, proportions historically. There's been delay, there's been, you know, foot dragging, there are bad actors, there are people who don't want change. There have been huge disappointments, setbacks. We had Paris in 2015, and unfortunately the US left in 2016, and we had everything that happened in the States. Thankfully they came back. But you could make quite a long list of reasons not to be cheerful in relation to this agenda. But I think that the other side of the ledger needs to also, we need to think about that. I represented the Irish government in Lima in 2014, which was the COP before Paris. Nobody thought there would be agreement a year later. And there was this extraordinary agreement, you know, 196 countries, you know, of all kinds of different backgrounds, complexity, size, wealth, came together and made this really stunning agreement. You know, now, the challenge is to keep to the agreement and to deliver the agreement. But I think it is important when you want to do the balance sheet, as you're asking, that to recall that that happened and that a lot of things happened since then. You know, that the young people across the world, across Europe in particular, in 2019 came together and, you know, insisted that things changed in Europe, and we had the Green Deal in Europe. The Americans have an incredible, there's been a huge turn in the States. Like the investment that the Biden administration has put into renewable energy and development is really impressive. The Chinese have made great, great advances. You know, there's real hope that the loss and damage fund was at the very beginning yesterday was announced that that's now happening, which has been years of struggle to get there. So there is a great, there are huge, very many reasons to be optimistic and to be positive, but quite a few to take the opposite view. So I'm on the latter side, though, because I think we have to make progress and we must have hope that we can do that.
Yeah, I suppose when you're being realistic, you can't give in to despair because then we wouldn't do anything, which obviously is the worst of all possible worlds. But Caitlin, one of the things that Alex mentioned there that has changed very radically in the last few years is the amount of activism from young people, and not just young people at university as you are now or young people in their 20s, but young people still in school who have taken very active stances, whether it's through school strikes, being involved in different direct action, whether it's being involved in different consultative assemblies. As a young person who has been involved in some of that climate action, how do you feel that came about? Was there kind of a tipping point? Was there a frustration? Like, what inspired you to get involved in the first place?
Fear. I think if I could sum it up in one word, fear of losing my home, fear of not being able to tell or getting my kids disappointed that oh, we're not able to go to this place now because it's flooding, or any, all the consequences that we've read in articles and we've read in research papers. So fear definitely was, I would say, the tipping point for me anyways, in terms of getting involved in climate activism. And so as a person who's been involved in kind of like consulting, leading like protests, school strikes, you cannot just talk to a young person without mentioning climate change. If we want to talk about transport, we're talking about climate change. If we want to talk about accommodation, climate change, economy, climate change, it's always on our agenda, especially like from Greta Thunberg and a massive aspiration and all of this, was the person that really kind of like pushed us to the edge of there's something wrong here. And because now out of fear for our future, we have to do something about it. The adults aren't listening to us, so let's make them listen to us. And so ever since then, it's just the drum that we kept beating. And there, again, we couldn't not talk about climate change. And any topic that we're talking about, climate change is always our number one. It's the number one on our agenda.
And when you say there about the adults weren't listening to you and you had to make them listen, do you feel that they have been listening?
How do I say this in the nicest way possible?
You don't have to be nice.
Yes and no. I don't know if everyone's kind of aware of the phrase of tokenism. A lot of young people, in terms of opportunities of getting involved and youth participation, youth empowerment, we're at a stage right now where we're over-consulted. We're always in the room of, hey, we want to listen to you, but are you, and then afterwards, after we finish speaking, there's no follow-up. Mm-hmm. There's no action after it. Mm-hmm. There's policies on paper, but there's no implementation plan. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that we're constantly, constantly being told, experiencing. And so we've just always been over-consulted, and that's the phrase I always use, but something that is tokenism is decoration. There is a lot of opportunities for young people to get involved, but in the front of it, it's just decoration.
Okay, because it makes it look better and as if they've listened to you. Martha, one of the things that Caitlin mentioned there is an inspiration for her getting involved, and many people of her generation getting involved, was fear. Mm-hmm. You founded the Maori's Conservation Association in 2016, after a number of years of very bad storms that really had endangered the future existence of the Maharis, which was a huge fear for many people in the locality. How do you feel about those last 7 years? You know, do you feel that there has been progress? And if so, has it been enough? Or do you feel it's only kind of the first step on a very long journey?
I mean, there's definitely... It's definitely on the agenda. You can see consistently in polls. It's now probably in the top three issues people will bring up organically when they're asked what their issues are. But I, like from the last 8 years, looking back from where I'm sitting, involved in a lot of community volunteer-run climate action projects, I just think there's a massive knowledge gap still. I think people find it hard to visualise or understand actually what climate impacts will be. Do we understand what it's going to be like to live in a world with 3 degrees of warming and 1 meter sea level rise, which we're headed for? I don't think we're thinking of that. And I think when the majority of the public don't see this as a priority, then naturally our governments may not see this as a priority. And I think... you know, for me, it's also a problem of the type of messaging. Like, there's no consensus on the messaging, because on the one hand, you'll have people say, well, if you take a very, you know, stark approach to your messaging and give people the reality, well, then you're just going to, you know, disempower people. They'll just switch off. But then on the other hand, if they're not hearing the realities of what it's going to be like, then there will be no sense of urgency that we need to affect this transformational change, this societal change, that we will need to meet the targets. And if you look back over the last decade here in this country, we've seen tremendous societal change through our referenda. And, you know, I look at that and I see how do we do that? And I think storytelling had a huge role in that. Listening to our friends, our family, and their personal stories, and finding compassion for them. I think that was definitely something that we can leverage. I think communities will have a role in that then. So if you get communities really thinking about, well, what effect will climate change have on these places that we love, on our future families, then they will be a fantastic advocate and driver of change, I think. Mark Little was here earlier. I think there's real room for the storytellers and the creatives to take over the messaging as well here. I don't know if anyone saw it, but there was this Mark Little and his team produced this Tomorrow Tonight program there, and still on RTÉ Player, I think, if you want to watch it. But I mean, that's depicting Ireland in 2050. Christiana Figueres had some really good articles in The Guardian as well a couple of years ago, just depicting what life is like in 2050, what life is like in 2100 if we change and meet the targets or if we don't. Yeah. And I think Creative Ireland is really leading out on this on a community level in Ireland at the moment. We're really happy to be working with them and the Dingle Hub on a really exciting project now for the next 2 years. It's on creative coastal resilience. And it's going to, it's actually very timely because our local authority, Kerry County Council, and the Office of Public Works have commissioned a study on our coastal area. So we're at Tombolo, incredibly vulnerable to the effects of climate change. But I think we can take that in the context of this project. And we will have the time and space with the help of a creative, with the assistance of, like, you know, academics like MTU, regenerative tourism staff, to really take this out of the box, you know, this issue of climate change. What is it going to look like for our community? And how can we co-create, you know, a solution and something that's livable? And then at the same time, you know, looking for action to mitigate the worst effects.
Part of what you're saying there is, like, obviously in the Maharees, it was very visible, right? What was happening was that the ecosystem was actually just going to disappear. And it's interesting that, you know, the Maharees is an agricultural area. Those of us in Kerry know the best spuds and carrots and everything come from Maharees. In a lot of the rest of the country, Alex, there's a big perceived urban-rural divide over this issue. When we look at party politics, we see a lot of politicians from rural areas, many of whom may remain nameless, but you, those of you in this room probably know who I'm talking about, who at times grandstand about the issue of climate change, about farmers feeling that they are being victimized or singled out for climate action that harms their business and so on. And it's perceived as an issue of conflict. How can party politics deal with something where, as Martha says, visualizing a universal threat is very difficult in and of itself?
Well, sometimes I have my doubts as to whether the party system that we have can actually do that. And I'm speaking as somebody who's a former, you know, loyal party member and served as a public representative and in government for the Labour Party. So, but I think that the configuration of political parties that we have and their history and their backgrounds and why they came into being in the first place and what their priorities have been over the years are not really aligned with what the challenge that we're talking about here in relation to climate. So therefore, what you tend to see, not just in Ireland but elsewhere, is that the most successful politics is blocking politics rather than, you know, politics that actually facilitates things happening. So you can stop, you know, or you can try to stop, we'll say, a wind farm, or you can object to the grid, for example, as I was dealing with when I was in government. But to try to get, to try to mobilise political forces to do something new, do something big, that's harder in our system, just the way it's set up. But like what Martha's talking about is a perfect example of local agency and community agency, then, you know, educating and then actually delivering change in at the local level. To scale that up nationally and globally, I think that we do have to think of new ways of doing politics. I don't think that you can just, there's no sort of clicking of the fingers and getting rid of conflict. There is going to be conflict about this. In fact, I think there's probably quite a lot of conflict coming in our lives, whether it's going to be in my life, but certainly in the lives of Caitlin's job. There will be conflict in the sense that people are not going to agree. And you mentioned here, I mean, we have to find ways of ensuring that the way we debate climate and the way we make decisions about what we should do about the climate threat should be all encompassing. I mean, you know, I know there are blockers and there are people in rural areas, but there's a lot of people, there are a lot of farmers and a lot of people in rural Ireland who actually do understand what the danger is and do want to work together with others and don't want to be seen as the bad guys and don't want to be. But and I think that farmers' organisations need to be in the room in a sense. And therefore, I'm not sure if our current party political, as I said, configuration set up to deal with other problems, not sure if it's that well equipped to deal with this. So I think we need to look at our politics, look at our institutions, look at how we make decisions. I mean, the Citizens' Assembly was a great example of breaking out of that kind of straitjacket of how we do politics on an issue like this. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of thinking that has to be done there.
Interesting. Caitlin, you mentioned there being kind of over-consulted, right? And you've been a member of a lot of consultative fora for young people, the National Youth Forum, Shared Island Youth Forum, and so on. You mentioned the problem there of being kind of listened to and then shunted out of the room when people make decisions. But what is it like being in the room with a bunch of young people discussing those issues? Does it feel different to when you see that being discussed in Dáil Éireann, for example?
The difference of the young people being all in the room, and then because I have also been in the room with policymakers in terms of like our curriculum, National Council for Curriculum Assessment, for anti-bullying stuff. So I have done I have experience in being in the policy room, but also being consulted. It's very, very different. The atmosphere is very different as well. As you said, there's a lot of conflict there. And whenever you said that we should invite farmers into the room as well, I would go 10 times steps further, say that you need the young people in the room, you need the travellers in the room, you need people of colour in the room, you need people who are across the border in that room as well, because we all live in this one island that we need to take care of. But I would say like the difference between in terms of just the young people and then the policymakers is that young people are much more enthusiastic. There's a lot more things that we'd like to get done on, and we want to see some action being made. But whenever it comes to the policymakers, there is that, what you said, dragging of the feet. And I've always felt that in there. But it's great having that experience, because then I'm like a lot of the young people now are very, very well equipped to negotiate. We are very well equipped to make our own decisions now, or be in that room, or might I well say vote. One of the things on our agenda is Voted 16, and it's something that the EU has passed, and we're lobbying politicians to introduce here. But the agenda can be changed, and being forefront of climate change can be in the forefront of Ireland's mind if young people are able to vote as well.
Yeah.
But if you listen to us once and then we remember that, we'll be voting in the next 3 years. So just be careful of the power of the young people. So.
Well, I wonder if I could ask, say very briefly, that young people changed those elections in 2019. Mm-hmm. Like that was directly the Friday, marches or the Friday events. Friday for Future. That changed those European elections in 2019.
Yeah. And if the vote had been 16 in Ireland, we would probably see very different results at times than we have otherwise. Caitlin, I wonder if I could ask you, we were in Wales there a few weeks ago for Other Voices in Cardigan. And in Wales, they have a piece of legislation called the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act, which basically mandates that any policy that the government in Wales brings in, they have a commissioner and a panel of young people who have to examine it to see whether or not it was considerate of what effects it will have for people who are going to be living 50, 100 years from now. Is that the kind of thing that you'd like to see in Ireland so that it's not possible to just be used as decoration?
Yeah, I have to do more research on the Wales, the well-being, welfare for young
future
people,
generations,
future generations. Yeah. I know the Department of Education right now is setting up a student voice unit to make sure that all policies across education is student-centered. That's its first year being set up. There is a National Youth Assembly now that I'm part of that's only been set up last year. Now something that's on a huge agenda is the United Nations for Conventions of Rights of the Child. That's always being rhymed off in terms of getting participation of young people. I'd say, yes, that would be amazing to have, but in terms of how you're going to do that, we need more pedagogies in terms of actually authentically, genuinely getting the voices of young people, because we can't have this decoration, we can't have tokenism. And there's a lot of optimism out there because there are a lot of people talking about youth participation, youth empowerment, but if you're just talking about it, there's nothing being done afterwards.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely. Martha, can I ask you, when we're talking about future generations, if you think about your children, the next generation on Maoris, obviously you've done amazing, inspiring work in terms of conserving something that was at great risk only a few years ago. But equally, as you mentioned, if we are thinking about a future in which the sea level is going to be a metre or more higher, it's very possible the Maharees is not going to survive in the long run. How do you mentally deal with that kind of generational issue wherein, like, something that you're fighting for now actually might be just not exist for your children when they are... Because there are a lot of people alive now who will live to 2100. You know, when we're talking about the future, we're not talking about something that's that far away.
I mean, we're talking 2050, and some would argue that we're already seeing, you know, Maharees, the geography of Maharees being changed by different flooding events. And it definitely will be altered by sea level rise. I mean, I just feel like we're a small little area in Kerry, and I think we've made a big difference. And I think we definitely are underestimating the power of what a little example, like, you know, like our particular project can do. And we've, when we started, there was very little awareness of the fragility of sand dunes or the benefit of them from a coastal defence point of view. And I think now we've just, you know, seen whole programmes take off, like Protect Our Dunes campaign, which is being run by Leave No Trace, Clean Coasts, and supported by CARO and, you know, various county councils. I think things can change. I think, you know, I suppose at the moment, I still go back to the knowledge gap, because I know there was a survey released there in the last month, Ireland Thinks poll, and 46% of people think the Irish government is not doing enough, you know, on climate action. 27% people think we're doing enough, but there's 26% of the respondents in that survey think the government is doing too much on climate action, you know. So when I hear and see results like that, I'm thinking, how can we bridge that knowledge gap? How can we explain to people, like, what's really going to happen? And, you know, it's for me, it's not just about what Ireland is doing as a country or what Kerry as a county is delivering in terms of emissions targets. For me, this is a moral obligation, a show of solidarity, if you think about it, for our descendants, you know, and what they're going to live with. And I know we will see climate change effects ourselves, but actually the worst effects are coming for our own children and our own grandchildren. And I that's what drives me anyway, for sure.
Alex, can I ask you about something that Martha said there about this idea of, like, doing too much and everything, you know, and the power of a small example of doing something the right way? Because a lot of those people who think that the government is doing too much are given an argument by people who are, as you say, against things, generally against action, against new things and so on, that, you know, Ireland is a tiny country in global terms. What we do about this is going to make no difference to the global ecosystem. Mm. Like, the decisions that are actually going to matter are the ones that are going to be made in Beijing and Washington and everything else. We could have a carbon-free island that would sink into the sea if the sea level keeps rising, because we can't affect the global system. But Martha mentioned there that idea of the power of example. Do you think that that is something that Ireland can, at a European level, if not at a global level, push more?
Oh, I definitely think that's the case. And I remember when we were going to, when, you know, we were approaching 2015, the Paris COP21, and Enda Kenny was Taoiseach, and he was going to do the leader's speech there. And we were having a row within government on renewable energy. And I was Minister for Energy, and there was a difference of opinion. There were different nuances and emphasis. No, there was a row. And it was really about, you know, what the rules are in relation to wind turbines and how close to people's homes they can be and so on. And I remember I was sort of resisting a change that was being proposed from another quarter. And I remember saying to the Taoiseach before he went, look, we cannot afford, if we're making arguments, for example, as he was at the time, in relation to Ireland being an agriculture country, and that, you know, certain, you know, that the agreements would have to have regard to the fact that agriculture was so important to Ireland. We better be delivering in other areas. We better be delivering on renewable energy. We better be, you know, making progress in areas that we can make progress, if we're seriously going to be saying that we can't make progress on, on certain other areas. And I mean, we've got an incredible amount that we can do here ourselves. We can do, we're already doing a lot on onshore renewable energy. We can do a massive amount with offshore renewable energy.
Yeah.
I think we can show, but in terms of the argument, which I think is more maybe the point that you're driving at, I mean, Ireland has always been strong, for example, on development issues. We've always been seen, you know, back to kind of Irish missionaries, that was a big thing in the earlier part of the 20th century, whenever. Now we're seen as a progressive country in terms of development and aid and so forth. We have a great name for that internationally. And we should be, again, building a name for ourselves in this agenda. We should be calling for change. We should be pushing for change. But we have to show form ourselves.
Yeah.
Like, we can't, and Mary Robinson makes this point, like, we can't afford to rock up to Dubai and make a speech and then have somebody get up afterwards and say, yeah, but what's Ireland doing about whatever
still
it is.
Paying fines for,
so,
you know,
you've got to keep your own, you've got to prove, you know, deliver change in Ireland, but the better to give you a strong voice internationally.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? That idea of like how you brand the country, right? And obviously there's been some, at times, relatively trite uses of our national colour, the green agenda and everything else.
Yeah.
But at
yeah.
the same time, it's also interesting looking back. I mean, I remember, I was thinking there when we were talking at the beginning about what has changed in 2016. And I remember being in college and the Fianna Fáil re-election slogan, a lot done, more to do, which I think is one of the classics of political slogans, because who could be against either of those two things? And I remember
Blair had used that some years beforehand, and Fianna Fáil basically lived, so they didn't think of it first, I think. But anyway, that's beside
I remember a slightly, one that probably won't be recycled, that should very much stay in the past because it was extremely insensitive, but it does bear thinking about when we think about the way that the country is branded, the Progressive Democrats saying that Ireland needed to become the Wind Arabs of Europe as a national strategy. When we look at some of these things now, like, they are at times branded as business opportunities.
Yeah.
Is that good or bad? Like, is that dangerous when it becomes a sort of like, yeah, well, we can actually make money through this rather
than... You can't get away from that. You know, you can't have a situation where we're only going to advocate solely state-led solutions, because, you know, we all have our views about the world we live in and, you know, how capitalism works and maybe how we would like to see that change and advocate for that change. But change in terms of the climate agenda has to happen now, and businesses have to be part of that. You know, they absolutely do. They've got to innovative businesses, innovative people who, yes, want to make money and who are, I mean, that's not the sector I'm in or I've ever been in, but they do, they will and must have a role. And they will want to have business opportunities. And some of those business opportunities will turn out to be positive for the planet.
Yes. And Martha mentioned there the idea of regenerative tourism, and we in Kerry see some great examples of regenerative farming. But Caitlin, I wonder if I could ask you something that you mentioned earlier on that, which is, you know, Alex mentioned there that the links between capitalism and the problem of climate change in the first place, and then perhaps in addressing it. You mentioned how when young people talk about this, you don't talk about climate change and then talk about something else. Mm. Whenever you talk about any political issue, climate change is related to that. Do you think that that's almost, is that a generational difference in political discourse?
I'm not sure. I would say
present company accepted.
Talking within my demographic or my generation, yes. Absolutely. We cannot get away from that conversation. We just can't. We don't even want to try to. When it comes to education, when it comes to transport, it's always something that we're always talking about. But you mentioned that like sometimes it's labeled as a business opportunity. And one thing that really stuck out to me whenever I was speaking to some of my colleagues in the Shared Island Youth Forum, and we were talking about the topic of climate change and how are we able to appeal to politicians, we actually had a full-on discussion for about an hour about how we can phrase the way we propose things that will appeal to them. Mm. And in a moment, it was more of a way to strategize so that we will be listened to. And I don't know how if I'm saying this and then you're coming like, oh goodness, how, like, I hope that whenever you hear that strikes something, like they have to rework, like, storytell in a different way that might appeal to the politicians so that they do more things about it.
Yeah.
And I came out of that thinking, we shouldn't be doing this, but it's something that we had to do just to appeal to them.
It's slightly, yeah, it's very depressing to think that we have to brand saving the world to make it attractive to people. But as Martha says, there is that knowledge gap. When we look ahead, I mean, there are reasons to be optimistic about certain things, there are reasons to be pessimistic about certain things. Obviously, the, you know, the general situation we are in is one that it's hard to overstate the challenges. But Martha, when you look forward another 7 years, another 10 years, what do you hope to see that would be different?
I mean, anyone in this room who's familiar with our work in Maharees will know that we were pretty radical with what we did, you know. We took a radical jump, you might say, in what we did. So just to explain, we had a sand dune that was decimated from decades of parking, walking, camping. It was lovely and convenient to park there because you could just access this amazing, the longest beach in the West Coast, like it's stunning. You could understand that, you know. But actually what happened was it started threatening the viability of the community because they couldn't get to their work, school, all of that, because the road was blocked from sand. So we kind of, without too much warning, just fenced off the sand dune totally, completely stopped any access. And honestly, it was not convenient for people. And honestly, they were calling us radical and militant and environmental bullies and a whole load of other choice adjectives and names that I won't mention here. But a year in, when we had this aerial footage of this amazing, thriving, regenerated dune, people kind of said, wow, maybe they were right. And then as we got Kerry County Council to provide alternative, sustainable visitor management facilities, the guards gave us an extra guard for the summer to control traffic. We had then started working with MTU on regenerative tourism experiences. Now we have people coming up to us saying, you know, our biggest detractors saying, you were right. This is, you know, this is actually, it all makes sense now what you did. So I think sometimes you have to be brave and just make the calls and do the maybe like say less than convenient. Climate action is inconvenient. But actually, if you look at the whole of, you know, what you're achieving as a result of it, I think you know that you're doing the right thing.
Yeah. Alex. Alex, what do you hope to see in the next few years?
I hope to see accelerated progress on what we're talking about. And I think that we have reason to hope for that. And we didn't mention, some of the political things that have happened in this country in the last few years. And I think that has been really strong and really positive. I think that there's, you know, we've new legislation, we've new climate plans. These are, you know, being not supervised by the courts, but, you know, the courts had to reverse one plan and the government had to come up with another one. And you see lots of, by the way, courts, young people bringing actions in courts in Europe, in Holland and in Germany, the European Court of Human Rights, saying, look, these generations, like my generation, cannot put all the burden onto future generations, and courts actually agreeing with that. So you see change coming from that as well. There's change coming from a lot of sources. You know, I'm kind of maybe a bit the sort of Pollyanna on this panel, I don't know, but that's because I think those points need to be made. If I was in a different panel, I might be fighting the other corner that, you know, change is too slow. And I think the two arguments are equally compelling, but there's a lot happening. And what, you know, what Martha says is so true. People working from where they are. I mean, that is so inspirational, you know, and young people as well. Doing what you can see on your horizon, you know, being really tenacious, working with other people. You know, you can't do it on your own. Building organizations, you know, if you're in a political party, trying to educate that political party. And I mean, I think in the though, you know, we mentioned about the political parties, but one thing the Green Party have done is they've educated other parties. You know, they've educated Fianna Fáil and they've educated Fine Gael in government with them. You can see that mightn't look like that, but I think that it has actually happened. You know, politicians, they get it more than they used to. Now, maybe because they just have to, because they needed the, you know, but that's okay. That's politics. That's what politics is. You know, you make deals, you make agreements. And I mean, the 27% in the polls who say there's too much action, like, I would take that it's not that I wouldn't worry about it, but I'm not sure how meaningful that is, because sometimes people react in polls based on something that they perceive as just, you know, they're reacting for a different reason. They haven't perhaps had the opportunity to analyze exactly the questions that are being put, and they may be reacting for a different reason. But let's not forget this, sorry. The absolutely critical thing is that all of the measures have to have regard to fairness and justice and equity. And that's the critical thing. That, you know, so many of the measures we're talking about with carbon tax can have a much bigger burden on people who are less well off, who can't afford it. Now, that's why the fallout has happened in France and to a lesser extent in other countries where energy price increases have fallen naturally, you know, have hit poorer people harder. And the politics of this have got to, just transition can't just be two words, you know, it's got to be, underlined with a real sense of justice and fairness in how these measures are introduced.
It ties to what you were saying, Caitlin, about young people seeing this as being all connected. So I wonder if I could give you the final word, as the one of us who will be around the longest. What do you hope to see in the next few years? Like, by the time that you finish college and so on, what would you hope to see in Ireland as a different way of doing things?
I think for me, I hope that I won't be scared anymore, that we have a future of hope and that there will be a bright future ahead of us. That if I get a car, that I won't be guilty of getting a car, or if I'm going out, that I won't be guilty, that I have to do more work in terms of making sure that policy is embedded, that there's no guilt there for us to live our life as we can. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, the overarching thing whenever it comes to the passion behind this. And I think I mentioned to this before we came on here that, yes, it... fear was instilled in us, and anxiety and frustration is what led and started this whole movement of young people trying to get our voices across. But we're trying to flip the script now and say that it is out of love for our country and for our planet that we want to make the change. And I think that's what I want to say the message today here.
That's a very inspiring one.
Thank you so much to Alex, Martha and Caitlin for joining me in Dingle. On forthcoming episodes, we'll be sharing some of the discussions that we held at Clebran, part of Other Voices Cardigan in Wales, last year. To make sure you don't miss that or any of our future episodes, subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a South Wind Blows production, and I'm Christopher Cassan. Thank you for joining us. I look forward to your company next time on Ireland's Edge.